President Trump has called global warming a hoax. He has vowed to cancel the 2015 Paris Agreement to reduce global emissions and appointed a climate science skeptic to run the Environmental Protection Agency. What is the future of climate change? Will science trump ideology, or will China lead the way in the green technology revolution? Ed Steinfeld, director of the Watson Institute and of the China Initiative, is joined today by Todd Stern, who served as United States Special Envoy for Climate Change from 2009 to 2016. Stern led the U.S. negotiating team for the Paris Agreement and was a leading voice of the Obama administration's climate change strategy. From Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, this is Trending Globally.
Todd, for me, one of the great moments in U.S.-China relations in recent years happened in November 2014 when President Obama and President Xi Jinping stood together in Beijing and issued a joint statement on climate change and climate remediation. That joint statement, at least for me as an outsider, would have been unimaginable just a few years earlier. Could you talk a little bit about how that statement came about and how you think it will be remembered over the long run?
Sure, and let me say, I will do that. I'll walk you through it. But it was, in my judgment, the single most important thing, that event, development that happened on the road to Paris. So I think it was very highly relevant. We'd been working hard with the Chinese really from the beginning, but in 2013, when Secretary Kerry came to the State Department, he had a real particular focus on wanting to kind of up the game with the Chinese. And I still remember I was in Chicago in a hotel, and he tracked me down and called me there and said that he was going to China in about 10 days and wanted to do a statement with them. This is 2013. This isn't the big one we're talking about, but and could I get a draft to him the next day? And so I said absolutely, and we were and we started that process. That led to a trip that Secretary Kerry took about 10 days later, in which the U.S. and Chinese agreed to a good statement on climate change and agreed to establish a climate change working group, U.S.-China climate change working group, to become the kind of central vehicle of our cooperation. And just by coincidence, about 3 days after he called me, and you know, we did some drafts back and forth with him, Xi Jinhua was anyway coming to the U.S. So for other reasons, but you know, for reasons having to do with you know on things that we were working on. So
and Xi Jinhua was already the Chinese climate chief.
Xi Jinhua was my counterpart.
Right.
He was the vice chairman of the NDRC, the National Development Reform Commission, which is arguably the most powerful agency in China. It's the agency that is charged with developing all the 5-year plans. It's a very very powerful agency, and he was a very senior person in that agency, and their climate minister, just as I was for international purposes, the U.S. climate minister. And so Xia was coming anyway, which was very convenient, so I raised with him the notion of a climate change working group, and over the course of the 3 days or so that he was in Washington, we knocked out we negotiated a text of a statement that that then Kerry was able to complete in China. Also in 2013, Xi Jinping had just come in, and he had his first meeting with President Obama at Sunnylands, an estate in California. And there were many things on the agenda for that meeting, but it turned out that the most important deliverable, to use a government word, that came out of that meeting was a short statement. I don't think it was more than maybe a dozen lines or so, on the issue of controlling an industrial gas, which is referred to as HFCs, and to use the offices of the Montreal Protocol regime, which is the regime to control ozone-depleting substances, to achieve those HFC goals. That made sense because HFCs were developed as a non-ozone-depleting substitute for other ozone-depleting chemicals. They were great as a substitute. It's just what people didn't realize initially is that they were hugely global warming polluting. So this was now an effort to reduce HFCs.
So the idea was just when the discussion began with HFCs, there wasn't really a discussion yet, at least here, for limiting carbon emissions.
Oh, no, there was.
I mean, it was in the background, but nobody was making any commitments at this point yet to real reductions by 2030.
Well, but remember, even starting in 2009, they were very serious discussions in Copenhagen. They were difficult, but they were serious discussions, and both the United States and China and many other countries did put forward programs and targets for the period up till 2020.
Right.
So now that was very much a part of the dialogue, but HFCs as a global warming agent was something that we wanted to address, and that I had started a discussion with Minister Xie when I was in Beijing, probably maybe 2 weeks or so before. Mm. It wasn't that far long before the Sunnylands, and then I had to come back here. Mr. Xie and I probably talked to each other on the phone almost daily.
Wow.
For about 10 days. And I would say there was not less than an hour of negotiation for every line of that short statement. And we got that done, became a big deal in the Obama-Xie meeting. So we spun out of 2013 having made some real bilateral progress with the Chinese. Secretary Kerry called me to his office in January of 2014 and basically said, okay, what do we do for an encore? We want to keep it, you know,
right.
let's keep up the momentum with China. And I said, you know, let me go back, sit down with my team, let's think about what we can do. And we had a long meeting in the conference room where we had all of our long meetings, and somebody on my team said, you know, what if we tried to do a joint announcement of our target with the Chinese? And we knew that the two leaders were going to get together in November.
Right.
That was already known. And my initial reaction...
You knew that, I guess, Lima conference was after that meeting.
That's true. Lima was following right after. But we knew, I forget if it was for APEC or some other international meeting, but we knew that President Obama would be in Beijing in November. So my initial reaction to that idea was, they'll never do it. Right? They're never going to want to do that because... they're not going to want to be crosswise with other developing country partners of theirs. But then still within that was just my initial reaction. But then as we're sitting there talking about it, I started thinking that would be one reaction, but there could also be a reaction that would be maybe even paramount in the eyes of their top political leadership, that this could be a big, big deal bilaterally. Forget about climate change per se,
right.
But this could be a big deal for the bilateral relationship if we could actually do that. So I thought they would, you know, one voice on one shoulder and another voice on another shoulder, and it might actually happen. So I went to talk to Secretary Kerry, laid out the idea and the argument for it. He liked it. At some point in pretty close proximity to that, I started talking to close counterparts in the White House. And not long after, Secretary Kerry and I went off to China probably February, I think. I have to look back at the record, but I think February of 2014 to first propose the idea. We stopped on the way in Seoul in Korea. Secretary had business there. We were there at night. I didn't need to go with him, so I called Minister Xie Zhenhua from the hotel in Seoul, saying, looking forward to seeing you tomorrow. I want to run something by you, sort of introduce an idea for
right.
you. And, you know, we probably spent, I don't know, 30 or 45 minutes on the phone, and I laid out this idea, and he didn't say no.
Right.
So that was a first step. And I said I thought it could be a very powerful thing between us, but obviously each side would have to be comfortable with what the other side was doing, because once you essentially have the image that the two presidents are going to lock arms and walk down the aisle together, if they had a weak target, that would be no good for us to accept. And if
right.
we had a target that looked insufficient to them, they wouldn't want to do it either. So So we weren't agreeing for sure that we were going to do this. We were agreeing that we were going to explore it.
It would seem to me, and one of the things that interests me so much about these kinds of deals is that there's so much potentially geopolitics involved. There's national development issues. There's national competitiveness issues. There's politics. There's bureaucratic politics.
Right.
And it just must be incredibly challenging to deal with all of those intersecting issues. How do you think, I'd be interested to know how you dealt with them, but how do you think your counterpart on the Chinese side, Xie Zhenhua, how was he dealing with those issues? Did those issues look different to him than they did to you?
Sure. I think they'd certainly look different to him than us. So you have to remember that for us, as a political matter, and I'm somebody who was always kind of, my stock in trade was trying to integrate policy and politics long before I had anything to do with climate change.
Sure.
Climate change, I came to climate change, you know, not at the beginning. I was a sort of political and policy generalist. So I worked on a lot of different things, but I always had that style and natural inclination to think about the integration of the policy and the politics. You can have a wonderful policy. If it's not going to fly in the political system, there's no point. If you're only thinking about politics, then you're going to miss on what the substance should be. So the people are built different ways. That's always the way I kind of was built. And with that in mind, nothing is more sensitive politically for us in the climate change context in the United States than China. And it's not just because of climate change, it's because China just still causes, in many respects, teeth gnashing, when you think about Capitol Hill, in so many different ways with respect to economics, its currency manipulation, its intellectual property, its unfair competition with respect to how foreign companies are treated in China. It's a panoply of economic issues. It's national security. It's the South China Sea. It's Taiwan. It's military competition. And in the whole suite of issues that involve human rights / freedom, it's censorship. It's the Nobel Prize winner whose wife can't go to receive the prize for him. It's Tibet. It's the Dalai Lama. It's religious freedoms. So many issues with China are fraught and cause tension. And we knew, I knew walking in January of 2009 that we weren't going to get anywhere unless we could fashion an agreement that China was fully in. Doesn't mean they do everything the same as us, because our economies are at different stages. But fundamentally, we are. When I say not doing everything the same, we might have X percent reduction, they might have Y percent reduction, but we were both having reductions, we were both having transparency, we were both doing the basic elements of the agreement, or else it wasn't going to work. So the lens of how could you do that and let China off the hook was an ever-present, I didn't think of it only in terms of China, I thought of it in terms of developing countries more broadly, but the first among equals, not even close, politically, and the truth is substantively as well, was China.
Sure.
I think the Chinese didn't have those kinds of, they have a different system, so they don't have those kinds of political challenges in the way that we do with a democratically elected legislature and Congress and all of that. But I think maybe I would focus on two critical features for the Chinese. First, they never, just as a general matter of the way they do business and the way they thought about climate change, they did not want to agree to anything that they felt would put an external constraint from some international organization or any other country on the way they felt they needed to manage their economy. They have a basic, to me, and I'm not a China expert at all, but I've learned what I've learned by doing. But the principle number one for the Chinese government is to sustain and maintain the primacy of the Communist Party, and that means political stability and economic stability. And so if they felt they needed to do X, Y, or Z, and to deliver a basic, there's a sort of a basic bargain, we're going to grow, we're going to be successful, we're going to drive forward in that way, in an effective way, and then that's part of the the other side of the bargain is, and we continue to have a monopoly on power. So they have to be, in their minds, they have to be able to control that, and they're very skittish about giving authority to the UNFCCC or anybody else to tell them what they have to do. So that was quite critical and is a feature that you could see play out even in those 2014 discussions. The second thing is that they, within the kind of politics of the negotiations, they very much were very keen on maintaining their role as a developing country, even though they had become, not by 2009, but shortly after that, the world's biggest emitter, the world's second largest economy, and even at a per capita basis, climbing rapidly. They both wanted, because it was useful, and I think genuinely saw themselves as a developing country. They were the biggest developing, we were the biggest developed, but we weren't the same, and they were very keen on not, I think they knew there was a risk once they were, you know, talking about walking down the aisle with us of getting their developing country comrades angry at them, but they were keen on, they wanted to walk down the aisle, but they wanted to do it in a way that was that where they could at least maintain their posture in the developing country community. So I think those were an international constraint and a domestic constraint, very different from ours, but their own constraints.
Right, and I guess there's also the risk, and maybe we're seeing it today. It's too early to tell, perhaps, but there's the risk of being either left at the altar or divorced later on down the road by the partner you're trying to walk arm in arm with.
Yeah.
How important is the personal in these interactions? I think it's been certainly publicly written about that you seem to have a very good relationship, or one that developed over time positively with Xie Zhenhua. How important is the personal?
I think that the personal, I guess I would say two things. I think, and I'll tell you a little bit about my personal relationship with him, but I think the personal is very important, but you have to understand that it's important within certain constraints. Countries act out of their own national interest. So you can't get so excited about your good personal relationship that you think on some issue that matters that the other side is going to in some sense lay down or depart from what it has seen as and what it has defined as its own national interests. And that's, you can't ever forget that. So within those parameters, I think developing a relationship of trust, developing even a relationship of friendship and affection helps. I think it helps to drive both players to try to understand where the other one's coming from and to be at least open to a solution to a given problem that still works for your national interest but can also take care of the other guy.
Right.
But I found all the way through this very warm relationship that developed over the years and all the way through the Paris negotiation, that did not stop the Chinese and my friend Xie from trying to beat us in the game. And only at the point where they would figure out that they weren't going to beat us in the game did you get to the, okay, let's sit down and work this out together. But I think without that relationship, maybe you don't ever get to that
right point.
And the relationship, I mean, it had many points along the way, but the truth is it started, 2009 was a quite difficult year for the U.S. and China, but we, at some level, we hit it off pretty quickly. And I liked him right away. He's a very animated, expressive, interesting guy. He's very clearly highly, highly capable. And I used to try to start off, even early on, with some humor and to tell him something funny. So I still remember a funny incident in 2009. I was driving around with my kids, who at that point, I have three boys, and the two younger ones at that point were 4 and 9, and they were having a lively debate in the back of the car. And it was with my wife about where we were going to go to lunch, and the little one was strenuously resisting what the older one wanted to do for lunch, and finally the older one, Zachary, says to Ben, okay, we won't go to Pain Quotidien, but then we get to do what I want to do for dinner. And Ben, the 4-year-old, said, good, I agree with you about lunch, but not about dinner. So I told Shia that story the next time I saw him, and I told him the whole story, and I said, so I figured out right at that time that he's been working with you on negotiations. So Shia just roared, and he said, no, he's working with his daddy. So, I mean, that kind of, but, you know, I took him to Chicago. We met in Chicago for one visit instead of Washington, because my hometown, he had taken me to his hometown in Tianjin. And I took him to the Cub game and to meet my friend, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who I knew from the Clinton White House. And we brought him, he came to our house for dinner in Washington when my kids were still pretty small. And just him and his translator and me, my wife, and three kids just at our table, you know, nothing fancy, just, you know, gave him some steaks and potatoes, and he liked American food. And
sure.
And he never stopped talking about that dinner in particular. So all of those things matter.
Right. I'm curious also to know whether the kind of engineering background that so many Chinese officials, leaders, people in important positions,
yeah,
and including Minister Xie, does that engineering background lead to a different kind of perspective or a different approach to negotiation from, say, the background that you have as an attorney, as somebody well-versed in politics, maybe not as focused on the technical sides? Does that difference matter?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you're certainly right that there is that kind of background. And one place, I know this isn't the thrust of your question, but I have a distinct recollection during 2014, in the middle of that 9-month negotiation that led to the joint statement, being in Beijing with the White House lead on this issue, my friend and original mentor in Washington, John Podesta, and we were, you know, it was a fairly big meeting, and probably 15 people on each side or so, and it became clear that Xie decided he wanted to filibuster that particular meeting.
Right.
And initially we were worried because we thought, geez, he's like pulling back from this. He wasn't pulling back. He wanted to make progress, but in a smaller meeting, which we subsequently had. But he probably talked for 45 minutes on engineering technicalities. And you could tell after a while, he was just going through each and every, to me, dull and boring.
And in
aspect.
China, universities, a lot of class units are, the lectures are 3 hours long, so 45
minutes
wasn't
even
long
for
him, pretty
right.
easy.
Yeah, right. But that's a sort of a somewhat trivial example, I suppose. But I think that we need to think, obviously, to be always mindful of what the technical implications are of any target that we're talking about,
sure,
or actions that we're talking about. And while that's not, sort of the technical side is not my specialty, I always had people on my team who,
sure,
knew that stuff well, but that's, I think it is more second nature, in my experience anyway, for the Chinese. And I mean, there's another thing about Xi's job portfolio that kind of supported this perspective for him, which is that he ran the domestic and the international side of climate. I ran our international,
right,
people doing the domestic side, and you know, what were we going to do in the automobile sector with respect to building efficiency, with respect to, you know, the whole set of the CAFE standards for cars and trucks and so forth. I mean, I always knew, but I wasn't deep into those details.
Right.
He was.
Right.
And I don't actually think he's, I'm forgetting now, I don't think he's there's so many of them are engineers. I don't actually think he has an engineering background per se, but he's deep into all of those,
right, right,
kinds of technicalities. You know, and that same trip to Tianjin, he took me to some factory that was getting built that I think was designed to be a sort of early experiment with a technology that's referred to as carbon capture and storage. And you know, you were walking all over the place with
sure,
hard hats, and that's second nature to them.
Yeah.
I would not have ever occurred to me to do that with him in the U.S.
Right. I partly asked because I think for decades, if not longer, there has been a fascination in China with technology,
yeah,
and the idea of technology as the most important, foremost solution to problems, as opposed to perhaps political solutions or other kinds of things.
Oh,
and whether
sure.
it's right or wrong, I would think it leads to just a different view of climate change, the opportunities, the costs, and maybe a different predisposition to certain kinds of solutions.
I think that that's probably right. And I think if you looked across the Chinese government, at least in many parts of it, versus ours, you know, you see in politics and policy, all over the place you run into lawyers in the United States, and all over the place you run into engineers in China. That's true.
Right. Not that one is good or bad, one better than the other, different, totally different systems and societies. I wonder, though, whether the more, I don't know, technical or engineering-focused view of climate change leads to, in China, maybe the idea that climate remediation, the upside is almost like a space race approach to technology development. It becomes the excuse or the linchpin for some kind of national effort to become technologically leading edge or dominant somehow. Whereas in the U.S., I don't feel there's that kind of strong sense. There's a strong sense of the cost of climate remediation,
yeah.
but not the fascination with maybe using this as a almost space race-like national drive?
Well, I don't know. I think at some point along the way, I mean, for a long time, the Chinese just flat out resisted.
Yeah.
And I mean, long time going back into the 90s.
Sure.
Were just very resistant to any kind of notion that the developing countries should have to do anything about climate change.
Sure.
That started to change a lot, really, in the period when we first came in the Obama administration. Remember, there was a kind of pretty quiet, passive period internationally on climate for the United States between 2001 and 2008 during the Bush years. But at some point along the way during the Obama years, the Chinese, and even starting in 2009, they got the notion that they were going to have to act. I mean, their emissions curve was off the charts high. And they certainly understood that the solution side of climate change is to transform the economy from high to low carbon,
right.
the energy base of the economy. Also some important actions on the land use side, but energy was the key. And certainly at some point in there, they figured out that there were exploding markets for clean energy and that
right.
they could be that could be a big economic winner for them and that they could become a dominant player.
Right. And not in, that... carbon emissions are related to particulates per se, but presumably some of the immediate pollution problems in China were an impetus to
doing
something.
But that also, the airpocalypse of,
yeah.
In the first instance, I think it was the January of 2013.
Yeah, I was
really,
living in Beijing at the time.
Yeah, so that, I think, had an enormous impact because that goes back to the comment or to the basic reality of the importance of economic and political stability for the
right.
Chinese in terms of the primacy of the Communist Party, because at the moment that an issue rises up high enough on the radar screen that it is a threat to that, they get real, real serious about it real fast. And the thing about that airpocalypse event, and I don't remember the details, but I feel that at that point there was a big leadership meeting going on in Beijing when the sort of the airpocalypse event really crashed down upon Beijing, and it brought home the gravity of the problem, which, by the way, was a visible and growing problem for many years.
Right.
I mean, the notion that they had a huge environmental problem with conventional air and, for that matter, water pollution was known, but it became really brought it home to the leadership. There was increasing numbers of demonstrations and unrest over this. And so I think that that had a quite important impact with respect to climate change, because while you can clean up conventional pollution without fixing your global warming pollution problem. And you can do that, for example, by, let's pretend you moved all the coal plants to Western China.
Sure.
And Beijing and Shanghai would be a lot clearer in
sure.
terms of air pollution, and you'd have all the same carbon pollution.
That's right.
But on the other hand, it's short-sighted and stupid to do that, because
right.
you're not in the long run going to be able to avoid having to reduce the carbon pollution. And if you can reduce them both at the same time by, for example, not just moving the coal plants to Western China, but by dramatically increasing your wind and solar and other things,
sure,
then you're going to, it's going to be much more economically beneficial in the long run. And they're not doing that perfectly, by the way. They're still taking some actions that will help conventional but not climate, but to a significant extent, they're trying to do both at the same time.
Right. I have just one last question. So in 2030, that'll be the point when some of the, I believe, some of the target dates for the 2014 agreement,
yes,
start coming due. And so when we reach that time, not really that far in the future, how do you think we'll look back at the 2014 joint announcement? I know you can't know the future, but how do you think we'll
I guess I would say a couple of things about 2014 joint announcement. Independent of the specific question you're asking,
sure,
I think that that agreement was the biggest positive jolt of momentum that occurred on the way to the Paris Agreement. That announcement, which quite beneficially, by the way, we managed to keep secret until it happened. So
right,
sort of amazingly, it hadn't leaked. The press didn't know about it. So it stunned everybody. I mean, I was in Beijing. The whole team was in Beijing. The press corps was there. And they did not have a clue that it was going to happen.
Right.
So it rocked them, but it really rocked the climate world, because the message,
right,
was, if these two biggest players, the two 800-pound gorillas, the historic antagonists, the representative of the developed and the developing countries, can walk down the aisle together, holy smoke, this thing's,
right,
actually going to happen.
Right. So, and if no 2014 joint announcement, no 2015.
Well,
Paris agreement, you
can't say for sure it wouldn't have happened. I'm just saying that paved the way to an extraordinary degree, and I can't tell you how many countries, including some of the historically most difficult, mm-hmm, recalcitrant players, you know, said to me at some point in the months after that, when we saw you do that with China, we knew it was going to be okay. So at some level, I mean, the targets had to be strong enough to pass muster, to look like they were for real, and I think they absolutely were. And our target is very, very strong. Chinese target, I think, was also important. But I think we're not going to get all the way to 2030, though. The way the cycles work, mm-hmm, most countries actually laid down 2030 targets. We're in the minority. Our target's for 2025. But those countries who have 2030 targets will, by 2025, if not by 2020, put forward new targets.
On the five-year cycle.
On the five-year cycle. So by 2025, they would certainly need to lay down targets for 2035. But even in 2020, where there will be the first review of everybody's individual targets, there will be a lot of pressure for countries to even increase what they've set for 2030, particularly, and this could very well include China, particularly if you're a country who has put forward a 2030 target back in 2015 and 2014 or 15, and it's then by 2020 completely obvious that you're going to easily meet that,
right,
target. By 2025, let's just say you're going to meet that target and go past it, or you're going to do better than that. Then so China, for example,
you can ratchet up the
yeah,
next
yeah, so there's going to
the
be a lot of pressure to say, well, okay, so you said you're going to peak your emissions by 2030, but it's now clear you're going to peak your emissions by 2025,
right,
so you need to do more. A country could say no, but there's going to be that pressure. It's not you're not forced,
right,
but there's going to be that natural sort of reputational pressure built into the five-year cycles of the agreement very deliberately.
Sure. And do you think there would still be that pressure if the U.S. is either completely somehow out of the agreement or the U.S. is dragging its feet?
It'll be different. It'll be different. I mean, not based on things that I read before, but based on my experience in the arena. I think the Madeleine Albright comment that the United States is the indispensable nation, you know, it certainly is true in my experience. I mean, people look to the United States. So if the United States has taken itself some version of out of the game, hopefully not all the way out of the game, but even if much less engaged in trying to meet its targets, much less engaged in trying to put forward ambitious new targets, that will absolutely have a unwelcome impact on the ambition of the whole effort in 2020. But I think at the same time, I also think that it's very important, and I will do everything that I'm able to do to try to help in this regard. It's going to be very important for the regime to continue, even if we have a relatively speaking less ambitious step up in 2020 than we had hoped. The fact that we have a regime, that it's balanced, that it has the buy-in of countries around the world.
A global climate regime.
The global climate regime, that it is premised on very far-reaching and ambitious and important targets, that it has this five-year repeating cycle, actually two different cycles, one that's an aggregate review every 5 years, which essentially starts in 2018, and a individual country review every 5 years starting in 2020. That's meant to drive the whole process toward those goals. So this is a really important, I think, a landmark historic agreement. I think people around the world saw it that way. And I think that even if we're a little bumpy for a few years, I devoutly hope that we can keep this going, because I think it's the regime that will, in the words of the president that I served in during these years, President Obama, this doesn't ensure that we do what we need to do, but it gives us a chance. And that chance to meet the climate change challenge is hugely important.
Thank you, Todd Stern, for all of your service to American climate policy and to global climate change remediation.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.